Hello, welcome back to Blood Ties. I'm Geoffrey Wonsall, but I'm afraid I'm here on my own without my daughter, Molly, who's busy doing something else. But so I hope you'll forgive me. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being there. Thank you for being so supportive. As you know, I've always wanted to do a little bit more with the podcast, and I'm hoping today will show what I mean. I'm doing an interview with a really talented crime writer called Tim Weaver about a book of his which I reviewed in the Daily Mail and which I think is really very good indeed. And he's an interesting man. And I hope it's the shape of things to come, because I want to do a number of interviews in the months ahead with all sorts of people involved, both in true crime but also in crime fiction. Because there is more to true crime than simply regaling you with details of dreadful events. So I hope you'll enjoy this, which I'm going to call an interview with Tim Weaver, crime writer. Thank you.
Tim, lovely to see you.
Welcome
to Blood Ties. I've been doing this podcast for more than 5 years. And we don't have many guests. So I thought it was rather good to have you.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me.
I thought it'd be fun. Partly because, as you know, I review crime and thrillers for the Daily Mail. Mm. And I've reviewed you a couple of three times.
Yeah.
So pleased to see you in the top 10.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for reviewing me, and you've been very kind about me in the past, so that's really, really nice.
Nice
of you. Yeah, it's been a good couple of weeks. Yeah, I can't complain. It's been three consecutive weeks in the top 10 now.
3 weeks in the Sunday Times top 10.
That's gotta be good. It is. Yeah, it's good. It means people are actually buying the book, which is of course
the idea.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we should just explain to the people who don't know. Tim wrote a very, very good book I much admired called The Blackbird, which is now available in paperback in the UK. And it's got a very simple but very clever premise. Tim, you can describe it.
Okay, so all my books are about mysterious and unexplained disappearances, and the Blackbirds, you know, no different. It's about a couple called Kate and Aidan Gascoigne who are leaving a friend's house, and they're driving down a country lane. They pass a surveillance camera and everything, you know, later when people check the footage, everything looks fine. They seem happy inside the car, but 10 seconds after they pass this camera, they suddenly career off the road into a 90-foot ravine. Pretty soon, the car explodes. It catches on fire and it becomes an inferno. And so the emergency services turn up at the scene, and they get down into the ravine, and what they find down there seems impossible, because what they find is a car that's been burnt to a shell, but no bodies inside.
It's a wonderful premise.
Thank you.
I remember when I opened it first, I didn't know what it was about. I opened it first. This would be last summer, early summer last year.
Mm.
And I thought, what a super idea. Super idea. But David Raker is your investigator of missing persons, is, you know, your character, so to speak. But he gets involved in this. But you've done a lot of missing persons over the years in your books, and very successfully.
Yeah, I have. Yeah. Well, I mean, David Raker is my sort of series character. So just to point out to people who maybe haven't read any of the books in the series before, you don't have to have read them in order. You can come in at any point. You know, they all act as standalones. But what they have in common is that they all kind of begin with, as I said earlier, a mysterious and unexplained disappearance, as an impossible seeming disappearance. And so, yeah, every book in the Raker series is really starts from the same place. You know, it starts from the point of view of of people disappearing and it being apparently in an apparently impossible way. So, you know, this is, like I said, it's a couple disappearing from the inside of a burning car.
Wreck. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And then, but previously I've done, you know, a man disappearing between stations on the underground. I've done a whole family disappearing in the middle of dinner. I've done a man waking up on a beach with no memory of him, of who he is and where he came from. So he's the missing person. And I've also disappeared a whole village, or maybe I should say a small hamlet of nine people. So yeah, every book is about a mysterious and unexplained disappearance. And that's really the starting point for each of the novels.
For your stories. But what was it, Tim, that attracted you to disappearance, to mysterious disappearances?
I think there were a number of reasons, really. One was that at the time that I started writing what would become my debut, I was kind of looking for a kind of niche, you know, like something that hadn't really been done before. And obviously when I started out, there were a lot of cops, a lot of, FBI agents and investigators and, you know, that kind of stuff. And I felt like I wanted to do something a little bit different. At the same time as that, I'd been reading a lot about missing people. I just happened to be reading about it and I found it really interesting. And I didn't just find it interesting that, you know, about 250,000 people disappear in the UK every single year. And although 99% of those people are, you know, found after a year, that leaves 1% who aren't. So that's like 2,500 people who are still missing after a year. And some of those people are never found. So obviously, as a writer, you kind of think to yourself, I wonder what these people's stories are. You know, I wonder what's happened to them. And especially in the 21st century, I think you kind of try to ask yourself, how is it even possible? Because the technology we have at the moment, as a society, is really built to get us found, is built to put us on the map the whole time. You know, we have mobile phones that are basically GPS units that you can make calls on, you know, until China rocked up to the party, the UK had the most amount of surveillance cameras of any country on earth. ATM cards were given over our fingerprints and our facial recognition technology.
And we have more CCTV than most.
We're given over fingerprints and facial rec to our phones. And so we're giving up information the whole time about where we are and who we are and all that kind of stuff. And yet people still do vanish into thin air, quite often. So, yeah, that all of that came together, you know, this sort of need to find a niche and to do a different kind of character, perhaps to what had been done before, plus all this missing person stuff. And it was like the perfect storm for me. That was like when I realized this is what I want to write about. This is the area that I think I want to go in. And so that was how it started. And, you know, I didn't honestly think that, you know, 14 books later, I'd still be doing it. You know,
I think it's terrific. You should be enormously proud of yourself.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah.
It's a great idea. You know, we've all read, I've certainly read an awful lot, you know, disappearing books. Because that's part of the genre. But yours are more interesting. They're always got a nuance that perhaps aren't always in some of the disappearing books. It's not just, oh, another captive or another kidnap or another abduction, or which, I mean, believe me, I've read so many, it takes my breath away. But yours have a freshness, which is very, very engaging. And
well,
I think that's important, because I think the audience, the readers, really want to connect, as Ian Forster would have said, with the character. And you found a character that they connect with, which is wonderful.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's lovely to hear that, you know, and that's obviously what you're ultimately looking to do. You know, you're looking to have readers connect with your books, you know, and connect with your character. And that was very, you know, very deliberate decision. And obviously there are a number of ways you can do that with characters. You know, there's not like one correct way to do it, you know, but with Raker, I was really trying to find someone who I felt was quite a sort of archetype that is quite underrepresented in crime and thriller fiction at the time, and maybe still is now. And that's someone who, a male character who was actually quite sympathetic and empathetic to people, who understood how people thought and the way they behaved, but not in a, you know, not in a behavioral science kind of way, but in an emotional and psychological kind of way, you know, especially.
Tim, I think that's absolutely right. I think that you're not doing Mindhunter. You're not doing the BAU. You know, that's not what you're doing. You're doing something much more interesting, much more individual, much more human in a way.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the human, you know, human is the kind of key word here. I mean, I think that's why Raker is so successful, is because he is, you know, it seems like a very sort of basic way of saying it, but I think that he is basically in touch with his feelings, you know, like he's not afraid to show his emotional side because he realizes that that emotional side is how he forms bonds with the families who are, you know, left behind, the families who have asked him to find their loved ones. And therefore, you know, by understanding how they feel and, you know, trying to get inside their head a little on the emotional side of things, he's able to get more from them, you know, than if he went in all guns blazing and did the kind of maybe more traditional thing, which you see a lot of in thrillers, which is very sort of damaged cops who are very monosyllabic and, you know, like have drink and drugs. And
they've always got troubles at home. They're always alcoholic. Yes,
exactly.
We've always been there.
Yeah, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. You know, there have been some very successful books to do that, but I just wasn't interested in writing that type of character. I wanted to write, I mean, you know, Raker has his own demons, obviously, and his own kind of his sort of crutch, I suppose, isn't drink or drugs. It's like this emotional, this grief he has for the death of his wife. She dies from breast cancer before the start of the first book. And, you know, so the first part of the series, he's really just dealing with the fallout from that, from the death and of someone that he loved above all others, you know? So that was just a conscious decision to try and do something that was a little different to what had gone before, you know, dealing with a grief that is more every day, I suppose, because, you know, during our lifetimes, all of us will be in one way or another unfortunately touched by cancer, you know. So I wanted it to be, and I hope that would ground him a little more and help, you know, readers connect with him a little more. And so, yeah, all these kind of things went together.
I think, Tim, it does. But was there something of you in Raker?
Yeah, I mean, there is. I mean, anyone who says that, you know, nothing of themselves goes into their characters, I think is either maybe not conscious of it happening or just outright lying. You know, I think it's, I think, you know, inevitably a lot of yourself goes into the character, you know, and sometimes it's in very, very obvious and overt ways. And sometimes it's not, you know, but I think Raker represents probably quite a lot of what I think about the world and how I hope that I treat people in my own life, you know. And I think that his moral view, is probably quite similar to mine, you know. And I think just by virtue of the fact that the books are all written in first person, inevitably it does feel a little bit more attached to the character than you might do if you have that distance of a third person narrative, you know. So because you're in his head the whole time, you know. So,
well, so I think it's what makes the book so immediate. I think that does.
Yeah, I hope so. Thank you. I hope so. I think that's what definitely was a conscious decision. I mean, I never thought about writing it in third person ever to start with. You know, it was always going to be in first person because I immediately wanted readers to be inside the head of the character and to really live and breathe these, you know, these investigations with him, but also to be very aware of him as a personality. You know, you wouldn't have to explain it because you could just tell it through the way that he interacts with other characters and deals with people.
But I think that's very important. I think that what makes him interesting for many people, certainly for me as a reviewer, is that he is human, that he is troubled, not that he's got troubles, you know. Grief is a different problem. But do you feel, I mean, obviously, we'll come back to Reykjavik in a moment. Is he published in America, Tim?
He's not. No, unfortunately, the Americans didn't really take to me and David Reykjavik. I mean, my first five books are published in the States, but they never really took off out there. So that's all that's been published out there.
Maybe we can help with this, because I have a lot of listeners in the United States.
Well, that would be lovely if he could.
It'd be really good to see him there.
Yeah, the irony for me is that I grew up reading American crime and mystery fiction, you know, so much more than I did British crime and mystery fiction. And actually, the books I feel are quite heavily influenced by American crime fiction, but they're all set in the UK, obviously. Although, you know, there are occasional bits set in the US, but they're mostly, you know, vast majority are set in the UK. But for some reason, they just never really caught fire in the States. So it's just one of those things, I guess.
I've got a great feeling that they might. Can we just do? I'd like to come back to. I've looked at your website this morning, and about the books you like, many of which I also like. The books that your favourites and many of my favourites. We'll talk about in a moment. But are you in any way inspired by contemporary disappearances, in other words, real life disappearances? Nicola Bulley, is that something that interested you, or is that just, oh well, that just happens?
Yeah, I mean, it interests me in the sense that, you know, I you know, you wonder what happened when it was going on, and also you feel an intense amount of sorrow and sadness for the family and the suffering of the family. I mean, I think that's another important part of the Raker series, is that I hope that they represent the traumatic, you know, event, you know, this, what a traumatic event this is in the life of the families left behind. You know, like there are obviously a lot of books about people going missing, but I really wanted this series to reflect the very unique kind of grief that these families who are left behind experience, because they have no body to bury. So there's no ending. So the suffering just goes on and on and on, you know. So obviously, when you see these real life cases, mostly I just feel for the families, you know, like obviously with something like the Nicola Bulley case, for a long time you were thinking, well, how is this possible? You know, how is it possible that they aren't able to find her? But the longer it went on, the more I just felt for the family. You know, I felt like it was just, you know, just an awful, awful experience for them, and something that, you know, they'll probably never get over. And so when I look at these real life cases, I don't look at them in a cold-blooded sense, you know, and like, oh, how can I use these in my book? You know, how can I turn this into a novel? I always hope that I'm very respectful of it. I mean, I don't try not to use real life cases as copy real life cases. I might use some elements of cases past as inspirational starting points for what I do in the book. But I mean, I take an interest in all this stuff, definitely, but I try not to incorporate it too much into the books, because I want there to be, I don't want people to ever think that I'm exploiting their sadness and their grief, you know, for my own kind of ends, you know.
Tim, that's one of the things that I respond to so much in your work. I agree with you, absolutely. That, you know, I talk about all kinds of awful perpetrators, and I feel more and more, literally every week, more for the families who suffer, more for the victims' families, because, you know, I don't want to glamorize the perpetrator. I actually want to talk about the damage that is done to perfectly ordinary families that haven't done anything to upset anyone, and suddenly their lives are turned literally upside down in the most catastrophic way. And I feel that more strongly every single day, that we spend too much time glamorizing perpetrators, and we don't spend enough time thinking about the damage that they've done.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in fact, that's one of the themes of The Blackbird is how, you know, when Kate, who, one of the lady who disappears at the start of the novel, you know, as the, it's not really a spoiler, but as the novel goes on, we find out she was a photographer and she was actually trying to do this exhibition where she was trying to represent the, you know, victims of crime, and not just do it in a they were victims of a crime way, but actually in a these were people. This is what they loved doing when they were here. This is how, you know, who their families were, what they, you know, what they did with their spare time, the things they enjoyed, all this. And so creating a more well-rounded view of who these people were, not just as sort of names and a line in a newspaper article about a murder. And also, you know, The Blackbird is also about how exactly what you were talking about, which is how a lot of these crimes are glamorized and the perpetrator is almost not heralded exactly, but is, you know, like they're the sort of star of the show. You know, look how many, you know, you go on the online on some of these websites, look, you know, you can search serial killers by numbers of victims and that sort of stuff. And it's just grotesque, really. You know, like these people that they killed, they're, every one of them had a family.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just, it's important that in crime fiction as well, you know, that that when we write these stories, that we remember that these are victims, and but they were people before they were victims, and they remain people after they're victims, and that we must remember them, their names, who they were, much more than the person that has taken their life from them.
I couldn't agree more, Tim, and I think it's one of the reasons why I suggested we did this, because I think you're absolutely right. I think I'm very suspicious now of what you might describe as a Hannibal Lecter style of killer. You know, he's the star of the show. Look at what he's done to other people. Now, I'm not saying for a moment, and I know on your website you quote Thomas Harris's book Red Dragon as one of your favorites, and one of mine, incidentally. I remember buying it when it first came out. It's a wonderful book, although the Tooth Fairy is really the hero or the villain of the piece, Lecter makes an appearance. But I think that that's what worries me a little bit sometimes. Forgive me.
No, I was just going to say, I agree. I think we do, you know, we as writers, you know, and actually as a society as in the round, you know, we have to be very careful about how we deal with this stuff, you know, and, you know, the media has a role to play. We as writers in our small part, you know, small corner of the overall, you know, world picture, we have a role to play, you know, in the stories we write. And there's nothing wrong, I don't think, with writing characters, you know, like Hannibal Lecter, you know, serial killers and that sort of stuff. But you need to, whenever I do, you know, villains in that ilk, I always try to give the, you know, you need to give the audience an idea of who they are and why, where they've come from and why they think the way that they think, because that will then help explain in at least in part some of the things that they do. I think the problem comes when you have villains who just kill for the sake of it, you know. So I would probably never write a novel where you have a serial killer who kills people in super elaborate ways, because that is then a celebration of how this person is murdering and brutalizing people. But the craziness of the crime scene is like the star of the show. And for me, that's not interesting. What is interesting to me are the human stories, you know, the stories behind it all. And so that's always what I've tried to explore in the books, is that, you know, even when in the past I've done stories about serial killers, I hope that they've been done in a very respectful way and not celebrating the, you know, these killers at all, but actually maybe trying to explain why they are the way that they are and why they believe what they believe, but at the same time not forgetting that there are victims in all of this and that the victim should always be known.
Well, I absolutely applaud that. Do you think that we bear a responsibility, me as a reviewer and podcaster and maker of television documentaries, and you as a writer, a novelist, do we bear responsibility for glamorizing them, do you think?
Yeah, I would say so. You know, like, you know, the impact of my books in the wide, you know, in the world as a whole are relatively, you know, like they're barely a blip on the radar, you know, because they're, you know, that is the reality of it, you know, but within your own tiny, you know, mote of dust in the universe, you have to like try and do what you feel is, you know, the correct thing. And I think the correct thing, as we keep saying, is to make sure that these, you know, we never forget that all of these people who are, you know, and hundreds of thousands, you know, maybe millions of people are killed within the pages of crime and thriller fiction over the course of, you know, years and years. So every one of us has some responsibility to do their part. And I think that, you know, it's difficult to say what's right and wrong, because, you know, someone who writes very, very, you know, violent serial killer thrillers, for example, might have a different perspective on it. But I keep going back to the same thing, but that's just that sort of stuff just doesn't interest me. You know, what interests me much more is the human stories. And the reason I say that is not just because of all the reasons I've already outlined, but also because I think within the pages of a book, you're going to get much more of a visceral reaction to your characters and to their motivations and to the way that they behave and act. If as a reader, you have some level of sympathy for them, or at least at the very least, even if they've done bad things, that you can understand where they've come from. If you've got a killer who's just relentlessly killing people, and like every crime scene is like this crazy puzzle, like the Saw films or something, you know, it's just like it becomes something completely different. And, you know, when you're watching something like Saw, you're watching it because you're thinking, oh, what cool ways can Jigsaw kill the next person and the victims? I mean, no one could name one single character who got killed by Jigsaw in any of the Saw films. No. You know, so that's the complete opposite of kind of what I'd be aiming for, because I think.
But I completely understand. I sense that from what you write. But that's sort of dehumanizing. They're just the victims just become a oh gosh, well, it's just number 12 or number 14. Yeah. But I've done it. That was the one with the cord in the window, or that was the one with it. And I find that in the end incredibly, actually, I don't approve of it, because it doesn't seem to me that is giving any kind of indication that perhaps this is not entirely a correct thing to do. It seems to me to glamorize.
Yeah, I mean, it does. I mean, this is sort of a tricky. I mean, I wouldn't consider myself like a particular expert on this sort of thing, but I just know I use Saw as an example just because it's the first thing that came to mind, but it's not a book, obviously, but, you know, it is a part of popular culture, and you know, in those films they get made because each murder has a very, very elaborate way of tearing someone to pieces, basically. Yes. You know, and that's why people go and see it at the cinema. Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with that per se. I just think that, you know, when you go and see a Saw film, you know exactly what you're getting. You know you're not going to feel one single iota of anything for any of the victims, because you've been given no reason to care for them, because they're just there to service the murder scenes,
the
basically.
Murder thing, yes, know? Absolutely.
Yeah, so but, you know, you need, as a novelist, as a filmmaker, whatever, you know, you need to... The way that you affect a reader or a viewer or whatever is by actually, you know, creating these three-dimensional characters. It's really actually not rocket science at all, but it's just that, you know, I'm not saying Saw is incorrect in what it does. It's been very, very successful. So, and, you know, I've watched plenty of the Saw films as well. You can switch off your brain and you can watch it and that's it. But, you know, I think to affect someone on a deeper level, you need to be much more savvy than that. And you have to actually work a lot harder than that.
But I think that's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you on the podcast, was that I thought that that's what you were thinking. And it's certainly what I was thinking. And I'm constantly asked, you know, I get stopped in the street, you know, why do you talk about these dreadful people? And I say, well, but you don't have to watch it. And they say, oh, no, it's fascinating. Mm. It's very complicated. It's not a black and white issue.
No, and it really is.
And one of the things that I thought struck me about your work is how you'd realize that probably intuitively, actually. You didn't think it through necessarily as a plan. You just thought that's the way as a human being I'm responding to these events. And that's what I want to create. I want to create some kind of empathy. I want to create some kind of sympathy so the reader understands the grief, the pain that people are suffering.
Yeah.
I think that's very laudable.
Oh, thank you. I mean, you know, I think, as I said earlier, there's no like, there's no correct and incorrect way of doing, you know, everything is subjective, right? So everyone is going to have a different view on what is acceptable and what isn't, you know, but I just think that, you know, there are certain ways of doing stuff, and you know the idea of doing anything in the sort of, you know, again, I go back to something like Saw, you know, that wouldn't interest me at all. But you know, as you mentioned, as a society, we are fascinated by these characters. You know, the reason that the Saw films or the Hannibal Lecter books or whatever succeed is because we are fascinated by these, you know, grotesque, evil people, you know, and we're fascinated by it because most of us are decent people, you know, we're decent people. So these people that we read about and watch and stuff are so far out away from who we are and what we think, where our moral compass is, that of course we're fascinated by them. And I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I'm not fascinated by them as well, you know, but we've just got to try and be careful and make sure, I think, that we deliver on, you know, the whole picture, and it's not just focused and glamorizing one aspect of it.
Tim, I couldn't agree more, and I'm delighted that we've done this chat. It's very important and very interesting. Well, I just want to finish, if I may. I mean, I was interested in your choice of favorite crime and thrillers. Mm. You chose, for example, a book I love, The Green Mile by Stephen King. You chose Michael Connelly, whom I adore. John Connelly, not to be confused. I thought they were very interesting choices of books that you admired and that had an impact on you. No, you didn't, not copying them, but they had an impact on you.
Yeah. I mean, Michael Connelly, I would say, is probably my literary hero. You know, like he was, I mean, he was one of the major reasons why I wanted to be a crime and thriller writer, really. I read the Poet when I was about 18, I think. I picked it up and I just thought it was incredible. And then of course then went back and I think there were like four or five Bosch books at the time that had come out. So I read them and then I've been reading him ever since, you know. Yes. And he was one of the reasons why I wanted to write a series as well, because I like the way that Bosch, you know, the events of one book never got forgotten in the next book.
Yeah.
And so they rolled the events, you know, the stories self-contained, but the impacts of that story has a gradual incremental effect on the characters they're going through the series. And I think that was really interesting to me. And that's something that's, you know, reflected in the Raker books, you know, none of the big things that happened to him are forgotten, you know, as they shouldn't be, because major life events in all of our lives, we don't just forget about them, you know, they're always there in some way. So yeah, Michael Connelly was a big influence. I love John Connelly's earlier books, where they were slightly more grounded. I know he was they always had such slight supernatural elements, but he's gone more that way, you know, in his later books. But I love the early books. They were just, and he's an amazing writer, like really gifted writer.
Well, Tim, I didn't mean to stop you, but we probably got to draw to a close. But I mean, the only thing I was going to say, the only writer who didn't appear on your list was James Lee Burke.
Oh yeah,
I adore.
I mean, I love James Lee Burke stuff. I just those other writers I just connected with, you know, more. But yeah, I mean, you know, those, one thing that I like about James Lee Burke is that his novels, you know, they're good page turners and stuff, but they're always beautifully written, and very, they're very literary, very gifted,
very
writer, you know. And so I love those book, I love those thrillers that can really combine beautiful writing with that, with, you know, that page turning quality. I mean, I guess a really good example of that, and probably one of maybe my favorite thriller of all time, is A Simple Plan by Scott Smith, which is just does both of those things just incredibly. It's an absolute rocket fuel page turner, but at the same time, it's also the characters are incredible and the writing's really, really good. It's just a shame he only wrote two books.
Well, Tim, it's very sweet. Thank you so much. And that's
thank you very much.
Now, have you got a book coming out? What have you? Have you got?
Yeah. So the Blackbird, obviously the Blackbird paperback's out at the moment, and then the next David Raker book comes out on the 8th of June in hardback. It's called The Last Goodbye. So yeah, that
is
comes
that
out.
A nod to Marlowe?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, a little bit.
I thought
it
might be.
yeah, definitely. And so, yeah, another author I love. So yeah, definitely a little cheeky nod to Marlowe, and yeah, so that comes out on June the 8th. So, you know, just going through the final stages of that at the moment.
Wonderful. Well, Tim, thank you so much. Tim Weaver.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Been a delight. Well, that was my interview with Tim Weaver as part of Blood Ties. I think it's the first time we've done a fiction writer on the podcast, which is really rather exciting. And I hope we're going to do one or two more in the months to come, if you're up for that. His book called The Blackbird is really good, and I reviewed it very favourably in the Daily Mail in England. So I hope you might be tempted to have a look at it. But I'm sorry Molly wasn't here, but she will be back very soon. We might be taking a small break just for April, but we aren't going anywhere, and we're there because we so much love broadcasting to you, and we so appreciate all your support. So I must immediately thank all the people that work with us. Sam Brain, our extraordinary producer, my son Dan, Molly's brother, who wrote the music, George, who did the caricature, everyone who helps us, Audio Boom for hosting us, but most of all, thank you, the listeners, for being there and taking part in this extraordinary journey. Thank you so much. And remember, as I always say, do be careful out there.